So today is two for the price of one day with Taishos. So the first Taisho is case two from the Book of Serenity. This is entitled Bodhidharma's Emptiness. Introduction. A man presented a jewel three times but didn't escape punishment. When a luminous jewel is thrown to anyone, few do not draw their sword. For an impromptu guest, there is no impromptu host. What's appropriate provisionally is not appropriate for the real. If unusual treasures and rare jewels cannot be put to use, I'll bring out the head of a dead cat. Look. Case. Emperor Wu of Liang asked the great teacher Bodhidharma, what is the highest meaning of the holy truths? Bodhidharma said, emptiness, not holiness. The emperor said, who are you facing me? Bodhidharma said, don't know. The emperor didn't understand. Bodhidharma subsequently crossed the Yangtze River and came to Shaolin and faced a wall for 9 years. Verse, empty, nothing holy. The approach is far off. Succeeding, he swings the axe without injuring his nose. Failing, he drops the pitcher without looking back. Still and silent, coolly, he sat at Shaolin. In silence, he completely brought up the true imperative. The clear moon of autumn turns its frosty disk. The Milky Way thin, the dipper hangs down its handle in the night. In succession, the robe and bowl have been imparted to descendants. From this, humans and divinities have made both medicine and disease. So that's the first koan. And the second koan is just a second. Case 6 in the Mumonkan, the Buddha holds out a flower. When Shakyamuni Buddha was at Mount Gridhrakuta, he held out a flower to his listeners. Everyone was silent. Only Mahakashapa broke out into a broad smile. The Buddha said, I have the true Dharma eye, the marvelous mind of Nirvana, the true form of the formless and the subtle Dharma gate, independent of words and transmitted beyond doctrine. This I have entrusted to Mahakashapa. Mumon's comment, the golden-faced Gautam really disregarded his listeners. He made the good look bad and sold dog meat labeled as mutton. He himself thought it was wonderful. If, however, everyone in the audience had laughed, how could he have transmitted his true eye? And again, if Mahakashapa had not smiled, how could the Buddha have transmitted it? If you say the true eye of the Dharma can be transmitted, then the golden-faced old man would be a city slicker who cheats the country bumpkin. If you say it cannot be transmitted, then why did the Buddha approve of Mahakashapa? Mumon's verse, holding out a flower, the Buddha betrayed his curly tail. Heaven and earth were bewildered at Mahakashapa's smile. So that's a lot to hold on to. The first koan involves an encounter between Bodhidharma and Emperor Wu of Liang, who was a real person. And Bodhidharma had a reputation, even before he arrived in China, as a great meditation teacher. And when he arrived in China Emperor Wu, who was quite ardent practitioner and supporter of Buddhism, was eager to meet him. And there, and his ministers at court arranged an interview. This is a famous event. And Bodhidharma went to meet Emperor Wu, and basically Emperor Wu said, what's the essence of the holy Dharma? What is it about the Dharma? What's the holiest aspect of the Dharma? What's the essence of the holy Dharma, this sacred, pure Dharma? And Bodhidharma said, it's not about pureness, it's not about sacredness, it's about emptiness. And the emperor didn't understand, and Bodhidharma left. And that was the end of their interview. Bodhidharma went up to the area that became the Shaolin Temple, the famous martial arts temple, many centuries later. And he sat in a cave for 9 years, waiting for his students to show up, And three of them did, two men and a woman. The second is an encounter that took place much earlier. It's, when the Buddha would deliver his talks, he would start walking up to Vulture Peak, this peak where you can actually go. Sandy has been there. And he would start walking up, and people in his followers would see him walking up, and they would follow him, because they realized, okay, he's going to deliver Dharma words. And they would follow him up, and then a crowd would assemble, and he would deliver a talk. But on this occasion, he doesn't say anything. People are waiting, they're assembled, they're looking up, and the Buddha, instead of speaking, just holds up a flower. And Maha Kashyapa smiles, right? And basically the Buddha says, Maha Kashyapa really understands, right? Really understands. So these koans seem to have very little to do with each other. And yet, there is a connection between them that's really important. We people in our Zen tradition, we work with koans, and this is a little different from, say, studying sutras, although it's very important to study sutras. It's very important to read the commentaries on the sutras and so on. But this is a little different. When you read the sutras, you're sort of imparting, you're receiving information that the writers are imparting to you. So the writers are giving you tools to think with. And, those tools can be very valuable on occasion, can be very helpful in understanding your practice. But on the other hand, they can also be obstacles to waking up. If I say that form is emptiness and emptiness is form, that's something that the Heart Sutra says, right? I recite some words from the Heart Sutra. I could say, form is emptiness and emptiness is form. And, when I say that, it might feel like I know something, But actually, I'm just holding on to some ideas. And if somebody said to you, well, what is emptiness anyway? Suddenly, you wouldn't really know. Having the language, protects you from your ignorance, right? But actually, your ignorance is what is actually the most liberating thing, actually. So if you say, yes, you know, the Heart Sutra says form is emptiness and emptiness is form. And then somebody says to you, well, what is emptiness anyway? Suddenly you realize, I don't know. Now, in that moment when you don't know something, you can really discover something true, something real, you know, that isn't offered to you by somebody else, you know, using your own powers of observation, your own questioning, you know, you can see something you didn't see before. Right? So koans are not like reading sutras. You know, the purpose of a koan is actually to plunge you into uncertainty, like focused uncertainty. And so each koan is sort of like forcing you, throwing you back on your own process of trying to understand something. And it gives you a little bit of a hint, and then it sort of turns you loose, right? So koans are designed to reproduce in your own practice the experience of the Buddha, right? You know, when the Buddha was practicing, he sat on the cushion just like we did. He didn't really know what he was looking for, right? He was really practicing in a spirit of inquiry, trying to find out. You know, when you do Zen training, that's so important. You know, in Zen we talk about don't know, the don't knowing mind, right? And this is really important. You know, when you're practicing, you're not trying to calm the mind. Although that does happen. You know, you're not trying to wipe away thoughts. You're trying to understand something you don't understand. In Zen, this is called the doubt sensation. So basically, when you're working on a koan, you know, you do want to be in samadhi. You want to be in deep concentration. You want to be in emptiness, the emptiness of samadhi. But then you're working on a question, right? And, you know, you may even find yourself sweating and perspiring. And, you know, you're doing what the Buddha did. You're asking a question about reality, and you don't know the answer, but you're searching. That's the proper spirit for koan practice, right? You know, I think it's quite rare, actually, for... I'm not even sure Buddhism is a religion. I think it might be somewhere between like religion and a science, maybe something like that. But it's very rare for religions to encourage doubt, right? You know, and that's true even for some schools of Buddhism, right? Like long ago, I had many friends in the Sri Lankan community, and they're Theravada Buddhists, right? And they all read the Buddhist sutras, the early Pali sutras. And, you know, basically, they're a little bit, this is not meant, this is, I love them, they're lovely people. But like religious people everywhere, they have an answer for everything, right? So, you know, if somebody dies, they say, oh, yes, as the Buddha said, you know, everything is impermanent. You know, there's a sutra where the Buddha actually, a person comes to the Buddha and says, my son has just died. This woman says, my son has just died. I'm inconsolable. And in the sutra, the Buddha says, well, I want you to go to each house in your village with a little cup and please... put into the cup a mustard seed for each family that hasn't had a recent death. And of course, she comes back to the Buddha and the cup is empty, right? Or there's one seed. See, and it's like, ah, I see, you know, death is inescapable, right? And actually, you know, death is a source of solidarity. You know, we all, So, you know, this story is right there for them, and they'll say, you know, mustard seed, and everybody understands, you know. That's valuable, right? That's valuable. But you know, there's something I have always found something vaguely annoying about that, too, you know, because it's like somebody dies and you're using your knowledge to close off the experience. You're using the knowledge to close things off instead of open them up, see? And a lot of religion, I think, has a kind of consolatory function. It's supposed to make you feel better when you're feeling distressed, right? So, you know, basically, if somebody dies and I'm called upon to talk about it, you know, conventional religious figure would say, well, you know, the teaching is that when you die, you're reborn, or the teaching is that when you die, you go to heaven or something like that, or you go to your ancestors, you know. And, you know, the Zen approach is very different from that. The Zen approach is to say, what is death anyway, right? It's in some settings, it's really unwelcome, right? You know, but the Zen approach is really not to, don't close it up. Look, make it a question. Make it a question. So we Zen people, we don't believe in, we have faith, but what we have faith in is doubt, right? We have faith, but we have faith in the process of questioning. See? And I think this is so liberating, right? It's so wonderful. You know, instead of saying, oh, he's gone to a better place, it's like, well, you know, was he ever here? You know, and that's a really interesting question. Is somebody, it's not a game. You know, we say birth and we say death, but what do they really mean? What does it mean to be dead? What does it mean to be alive? What does it mean to be alive? See, and we Zen people, we approach these questions, or we pose these questions in a special consciousness. You know, like ordinary consciousness might say, well, you know, scientists say that, you know, death is really when your brain waves stop after, you know, that's really not what we do. You know, what we Zen people do is we go into deep samadhi, deep mushin, and then we pose the question, and we allow a bigger mind to answer the question, see? And we believe, and there's good evidence for this, that consciousness is not all there is to, conscious awareness is not our only awareness, or even our deepest awareness. That, you know, consciousness is like a little subset of our bigger mind, our bigger consciousness. I was just listening, driving over here to this program about music, right? And the person was talking about the therapeutic elements of music. And he said, you know, people in the 19th century and the 20th century were so dismissive of things like the health benefits of music. They just thought that was unscientific. But he said, you know, now we've done all these studies and music has this profoundly curative, you know, restorative effect. And he started talking about how, you know, when we hear things, we're not really hearing the sounds. He said, our eardrums are going in and out. Sound waves make our eardrums go in and out. And he said, that sends all these little signals. And he said, actually, our brains construct Mozart, you know, out of these little signals. You know, we Zen people believe something similar, which is that, you know, under the surface of our consciousness, there's this deeper intelligence, right? And this intelligence is, at its core, fundamentally enlightened. Right? So you know, koan practice puts a lot of faith in the power of our unconscious mind, and we believe that at the core of that unconscious mind there's this enlightened awareness. Right? So when something happens, when somebody dies, you know, we don't try to cover it up. we sit down on the cushion and say, what is death? What is death anyway? Right? And as long as you're operating in the realm of ideas, you're still in the realm of conventional, you're not really asking questions, right? You know, when you go deeply into Mushin and you might say death as your turning phrase, you know, all of this stuff begins to happen. All of these, all this, your mind goes through this process, which is very sophisticated and complicated. You know, memories come up, these powerful emotions, and it's as though you're being taken on a journey. Right? It's like you're being taken on a journey. And you work through your thoughts, you work through your memories, all these emotions, and eventually you have like this insight. You have this moment of insight. And that's the moment you often bring into the Dokusan room and report to the teacher. Right? So anyway, Zen is a process of asking questions in a certain kind of consciousness, right? And you could say all of these different koans are trying to lead you into awakened consciousness by looking at different questions, like different experiences in life that assault us or block us or hurt us or confuse us, right? And Zen koans are like this collection of these little moments when people were stymied, and instead of relying on words and ideas, they guide us deeper and deeper into our minds, into the core of our consciousness. And when we have a little insight that comes from the core of our consciousness, that's like a little glimpse of enlightenment. So all of these different koans are leading us, you could say, to the same place, or the same place. And they're starting in different places. They're starting in different, with different questions and different problems. But actually, if we pursue them, you know, we go down through the layers of the mind and we eventually have this glimpse of enlightened mind. And we do that enough times and, you know, the enlightened mind becomes really who we truly are, right? Who we truly are. So these two koans seem completely unrelated, but you could say under the surface, on a unconscious level, or beneath the level of our ordinary language and thinking, they're deeply linked. Right? So, why don't I, let's go back to the this koan, the Buddha holds out a flower. You know, this is such a challenging koan for people. If you give it to them when they're beginners, it really, this is like, it's such a simple koan. And when I was first starting out as a Zen teacher, I would give this koan to people, and it would just drive them crazy. It was such a tough koan, you know. And some people would be stuck on it for a year, you know. And so I stopped giving it out to beginners because I just think it's too tough, right? And it's tough because you either see it or you don't. You either get it or you don't. Right? So you know, the Buddha walks up Vulture Peak, and he holds up a flower. He holds up a flower, and all these people see the flower. You know, they're all looking at the flower, and they're all, encountering the flower. But the Buddha says, you know, only Mahakashapa, who smiles, really gets it. And, you know, we'd all like to be when I was working with this koan, I certainly wanted to be like Mahakashapa, the person who really gets it. I sat with this myself for months and months, you know, and When I would walk to the Zen Center from my house on 9th Avenue in Seattle, or walk to the bus to get to the Zen Center, you know, I would look at all the flowers. I started reading about flowers. You know, I'd stare and stare at these flowers, right? And I just couldn't answer this koan. You know, and when I was working with the koan, I would think about flowers, you know, in my life. You know, so my grandmother, you know, for example, lived in upstate New York, and she had a farm. My grandparents had a farm up there, and one of the things my grandmother liked was gladiolas. I don't know if you know what gladiolas are, but gladiolas are these flowers that have this tall stalk, and there are these beautiful bell-like flowers that grow out of the stalk. And my grandmother was absolutely, she had this huge vegetable garden, she had an orchard, you know, in the summer, she was busy in the garden all summer long, and dinner pretty much came out of the garden. It was really wonderful. But she always had this big, circular, it was pretty big circle, and it was just like solid gladiolas, right? And she'd cut them off at the base and bring them in and put them in these giant vases. And all, you know, I had never seen anything like it. So when I was working with the koan, I kept thinking about these, and I thought about my grandmother, who I really loved, used to love to visit her. And I remember, you know, I would take flowers into Genki Roshi. I talked to him about my, you know, I said, gladiolas. Right? And that was my answer once. And he said, well, tell me about gladiolas. And I told him about my, he said, that's wonderful. You know, it's not really the answer to the koan. And I couldn't get it. I couldn't get it for the life of me. It's like, it's a really tough koan. You know, and, you know, in a way, I was in the same place as the Emperor Wu of Liang. You know, the Emperor Wu of Liang was this really serious guy. He actually took over from a murderous maniac, you know. His predecessor was truly like an evil, evil person, like unbelievably evil. If I told you how evil it would, you'd be astounded, right? He actually was like, about as bad as, he was like a Hitler sort of guy, right? And he actually had a room, according to Chinese history, where the wallpaper was like human skin, right? So really bad guy. There are such people in the world. And he got to the point where he was just killing so many people that his generals just couldn't stand it anymore. And they weren't nice people. But they finally killed him, right? Anyway, people were so tired of all the evil that they decided that they would make Emperor Wu the emperor. And he was this wonderful guy. You know, he became very interested in Buddhism in middle age, and he began to meditate, and he he transformed the country. You know, he appointed people who were wise and good. You know, it really, he did this wonderful turnaround. It was just like this hell had turned into this wonderful place. And a lot of his inspiration came from his meditation practice, and he brought these meditation teachers from all over China, right? And he built some temples, and he endowed like lecture series, and you know, people were afraid that he would go on the weekends up to the temple and live with the monks, and people were terrified he was just going to abdicate, and these maniacs would come back. He didn't do that, but he would go up there and meditate. Anyway, very good man, right? Like a super good human being. And you know, Bodhidharma comes, and he says, well, tell me about the holy Dharma. And Bodhidharma says, it's not about holiness, Your Majesty. You know, it's about emptiness, vast emptiness. And you know, Wu just didn't get it. You know, he had read a lot of sutras. He was a good man, but he couldn't get it. Most people have no idea what we're doing on the cushion. I've even had people say that to me, like, you know, you guys are just sitting on this cushion, not moving. What's that all about? You know, but strange things happen when you practice. When you practice this, you know. So you could be coming from, you know, work, and things at work could be terrible, right? I mean, I know this. I mean, for a long time I had this administrative position, and you know, if you're like a mid-level manager, you're in such a difficult situation because you don't get to make policies, right? You have to carry policies out. So you're like, you know, you're the guy they send to the people who are working, and you're supposed to deliver the policy and sell the policy. Right? And, you know, behind the scenes, you can object, you know, but at some point you're actually sort of like bound to carry it out. And I can remember years ago, this was like 25 years ago, some dean had decided there was this big cost-cutting thing, and I had to fire 6 people who had worked for me for like a dozen years. Oh, and I did everything I could to figure out how to come up with that money without firing those people. And actually, I had to fire them. And actually, I hired them all back. It took about 4 years, but I got them all back, you know. And they're still working here, you know. So, but it caused me a lot of emotional distress. And I remember, you know, coming into this room, as a matter of fact, and sitting down on the cushion, right, and just being on fire with, you know, anger and, you know, feeling pain and you sit down and you watch your breath, and after a while, you know, your mind becomes still, even if these terrible things are happening, your mind becomes still. And then, you know, after it becomes still, you know, you merge with your breath, you become one with the breath. And then, you know, after you become one with the breath, you can stay in that state, which we call samadhi in Zen. It's a kind of samadhi, but we just call it samadhi. It's breath samadhi, right? You become one with the breath, and when you become one with the breath, you stop self-referencing, right? And you actually stop thinking. You're now just focused on your unification with the breath. And it's very grounding. It unifies body and mind, right? Your concentration is harmonized with your breathing. You know, so it's a very grounding place to be, and you can feel very almost blissful in that state, right? So then, you know, people who don't practice with good teachers or who don't have a teacher, you know, often understand that state as like the point of meditation. But as I've said before, you know, if you become attached to that state, you are really not awakened. You're not really even liberated. Right? You've just become attached to a particular kind of consciousness. And if somebody interrupts you when you're in that beautiful state, you might even find yourself getting mad. So if you don't stay in that state and you watch the breath go out, out, out until it's gone, and you keep coming back, you'll notice at the end of the breath there's this little blank space. And when you begin to go into this blank space, right, at first it might seem insignificant. But eventually, you know, you begin to experience that blankness as vast, really, not small. At first it's like this. But gradually, the more you go into that emptiness, the more, the larger and more encompassing it becomes. And you keep going into that emptiness and going into that emptiness. And, you know, that is really what Bodhidharma was trying to point out to Emperor Wu of Liang. He was trying to say, this is really the door into enlightened mind. And you know, until you can get to that place, until you can reach that place, you really are like a blind man groping, in, you know, groping around, right? It's like you're only seeing half of the picture at any particular, it's like you're only seeing a small portion of the picture at any particular moment. It's like you have you have half a coin, and you're trying to find the other half, but you don't even know that it exists. And once people reach that emptiness, now they can put the two halves of the coin together, and they see in a very different way, right? So you know, when I remember being in this great emotional state of turmoil. And coming here and sitting on a Saturday, you know. And, you know, I got up and I went outside and you know, I looked around and I felt so, there was no separation between myself and the world outside, right? No separation. And it was as though, you know, and this, I'm sure this is how you've had experiences like this too. If after sitting for half a day, you go outside and everything seems so alive. Everything seems so, sometimes so, even if it's not beautiful, there's something, it's like there's an added dimension to it. And, you know, you might not notice, but, you know, when you see the tree or when you see the grass, there's really like no self present. It's just like you are the grass, you are the flowers, right? And you know, when I was going through that emotional turmoil, you know, I realized, you know, that in this, these things that are happening are also my true nature. Right? These events that are happening to me are also. This is my life right now, you know. And even though these things were out of my control, you know, I felt kind of, I felt no sense of separation from these events, you know. And I think that that oneness, you could say, with even these terrible events is what allowed me to respond to them creatively, right? It's like when something terrible happens, we want to create a wall between ourselves and that event. We want to protect ourselves. But, you know, when something terrible happens and you say, this is who I really am. This is my life, right? I think you're in a much better position to respond compassionately and creatively. So you know, Emperor Wu of Liang is he doesn't know about emptiness. It's like he sees half the picture. And most people probably live that way, but it's that mindset is always isolated, always separate, you know. Once you experience emptiness, right? Once you experience emptiness, everything changes. Everything becomes, in a certain sense, your true self, your own body. So, you know, Emperor Wu of Liang must have learned that. I guess I hope he did. But, you know, in our Zen training, you know, the teacher will at some point say to you, you know, I want you to work with this koan. The Buddha holds up a flower. And You know, if you haven't experienced emptiness, if you don't know how to go into that emptiness, you know, the flower is always separate from yourself. You know, you can talk about your grandmother's flower, you can bring the teacher a flower. But when you know how to get into emptiness, you know, what you discover, and I think it's really absolutely amazing, is, you know, there's like a underlying unity to everything. It's like this underlying unity. And, you know, we discover that underlying unity when we practice with Mushin, when we know how, when we've encountered emptiness, and we make emptiness sort of the door through which we enter the world. You know, there, you know, you'll sometimes hear people say things like, there is another world, there is another world. You know, religious people will say, there's another world, you know. And, you know, maybe they mean heaven, right? There's another world, meaning heaven, right? Or there's another dimension, right? And people think, well, what could that dimension be? Well, I think there is another world, and I think most people aren't aware of it. But I don't think it's in heaven, you know. I think the other world is, I think this world is inside that other world, you know, so to speak. And I think this world that we live in is like inside the bigger world. And, you know, as long as we're in our discriminating minds, what we're seeing isn't like always wrong or fantasy, but it's incomplete. Right? It's incomplete. And in our little discriminating mind world, things are separate. In fact, that's what discriminating thought does. It separates everything. So, you know, when I look at the flower, it's a dahlia, or it's a rose, or it's a gladiola, right? Because I'm only seeing half the picture. Right? It's like what we call emptiness is actually like the connecting principle. It's like emptiness is the thing that connects all of these broken pieces that we call our reality. Right? And so when we don't know about emptiness and we look around at the world, all we see are fragments, all we see are pieces, you know? And they're all sort of lying on the ground, and they may give us pleasure, or they may cause us pain, but it's all very broken up and fragmented. And, you know, you can try to fit them together using your very clever mind, but they'll never fit together, because what holds them together is, like, not accessible to our discriminating mind. You know, you have to step outside of that mind and enter what we call emptiness. And then everything seems connected, because everything is connected, just not in a way our discriminating mind can understand. So it's like, you know, fundamentally everything is connected. But, you know, when we start using our language skills and our ideas, we're really separating ourselves from that unity. And when we so like turn those off, and we learn how to get into Mushin, everything we experience becomes, we feel like it's part of us, or we're part of it. And that's because, you know, we're inside this bigger thing. And, you know, our word for that enclosure is emptiness, because it's beyond our understanding. But it's absolutely here, and it's deeply transformative. Every time I go into emptiness and I come out, you know, this powerful sense of connectedness is present. You can say, where is that coming from? But it's like the two halves of the same coin. It's like something and nothing form an emptiness. You know, really, you know, this is together, this is our reality. So I don't know if the Emperor Wu of Liang ever figured this out or not, but it's so important it's so important. As soon as you know how to go into emptiness, everything becomes your true self. Everything becomes part of this bigger life. When Shakyamuni was at Mount Gridhrakuta, he held out a flower to his listeners. Everyone was silent. Only Mahakashapa broke into a broad smile. The Buddha said, "I have the true Dharma eye, the marvelous mind of Nirvana, the true form of the formless, and the subtle Dharma gate, independent of words and transmitted beyond doctrine. This I have entrusted to Mahakashapa." So everybody in the audience is, you know, looking at this flower, and some people are thinking of their grandmother's gardens, and some people are thinking, ah, love, you know, springtime, love, a flower, and it's beautiful, right? Only Mahakashapa experiences the flower in deep emptiness, right? And when he experiences the flower in deep emptiness, he realizes that it's all one life. And the Buddha smiles. Momon's comment, golden-faced Gautama really disregarded his listeners. He made the good look bad, and he sold dog meat labeled as mutton. So in the Momonkan, when Momon is insulting somebody, he's actually praising him. It's sort of a Zen thing. In this case, he's saying, on this occasion, the Lord Buddha presented the truth in such a direct way that very few people could understand it, because they hadn't understood emptiness yet.
Right.
But it was the deepest truth. He himself thought it was wonderful. If, however, everyone in the audience had laughed, how could he have transmitted his true eye? And again, if Mahakashapa had not smiled, how could the Buddha have transmitted it? If you say the true eye of Dharma can be transmitted, then the golden-faced old man would be a city slicker who cheats country bumpkins. If you say it cannot be transmitted, then why did the Buddha approve of Mahakashapa? So now we know how to answer those questions. See, Zen, always more questions, right? So wonderful, right? You know, what is breath? You know, we don't know. Go into emptiness and find out, right? What is life? We don't know. Go into emptiness and find out. What is death? We don't know. What is love? Really, what is love? We say, oh, love. What is love? Go into emptiness and find out. What is pain? You know, right? Okay. Mumon's verse. Holding out a flower, the Buddha betrayed his curly tail. In other words, he was kind of a monster. Heaven and earth were bewildered at Mahakashapa's smile.